Carolina Ebeid, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you,
and
Daniel.
Welcome to El Paso, Texas.
Lovely to be here with you.
Have you been to El Paso before this?
I haven't, except that I did fly into El Paso and then was driven to
Las Cruces.
Marfa, Texas.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
I was about to say, yeah, people have to fly into El Paso for Marfa and for Las Cruces. Well,
yeah.
Welcome here.
Thank you.
Been teaching our graduate poetry seminar, and how is that going?
It's going remarkably well, I think. I am getting the hang of it. You know, having to orchestrate conversation and discussion of the book, which is difficult enough in English to explain and try to understand, in other words,
right.
a poem, to do that in multiple languages is tough, but I love it.
Great opportunity, huh?
Yeah.
And good for the brain.
Yes,
definitely
it's great.
Good for the brain. And, you know, I'm all about brain health these days, being a veteran. Let's start with a little bit of your background. How did you become a poet? How did you find poetry, or how did poetry find you, whatever?
I think that it was always something that was going to happen. I was encouraged at a young age. I think I showed some kind of affinity with language in kindergarten and first grade, and it was something that...
That early?
That
wow.
early, yeah. I think at home, you know, the fact that I grew up in a house full of people that, you know, where there was Arabic and English and Spanish being
wow.
spoken, I think that had a great effect,
right.
Speaking of the brain,
right.
on the brain to hear all of those
yeah.
sounds. I think also, though, there was something about how my parents spoke of their respective places, my mother mm-hmm. from Cuba and my father Palestinian,
right.
how they always spoke of home, of the quote-unquote back home.
Wow.
There was something instilled, some kind of longing for
right.
an elsewhere that just wasn't present.
Oh, well, that's beautiful. That sounds like the two elements that make up a poet,
yeah.
the language and then the wanting to reach beyond
right.
or the ineffable. That's beautiful. And, you know, I can't help but think of when I was a kid. I learned Spanish on my own, and you ask any of our students, who are mostly from Latin America, and, does Chacon speak Spanish? And they'll laugh, right? My
mm-hmm.
Spanish is horrible, but it's because I had to learn myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being a kid listening to the aunts talk in the bedroom and the uncles talk in the living room, and they were all speaking Spanish, and I would fall asleep to the sound of it. I didn't understand it, but it was beautiful. It was like music. Did you understand the Arabic and the Spanish when you were growing up?
I understood the Spanish because my maternal grandmother, mi abuela, lived in the house.
Okay,
so there
right,
was
right.
literally Spanish being spoken to me and
right.
to each other. So I grew up speaking Spanish. Arabic, no, but you describe exactly what it was like for me to, in Arabic family
uh-huh.
gatherings, to hear it and to not understand it, but to understand something
right,
of it,
right.
to understand when it was loving,
right.
to understand when there were some kind of argument going on.
You pay more attention to the rhythm and to the ups
tone,
and downs.
The tone, right?
And,
yeah. Yeah, that's what it was
I
like.
Can't help but think of Joyce when he writes about, I think it's in Ulysses, it's been so long, but he writes about hearing the cleaning woman speaking Gaelic and how he didn't know the language, but he grew up around it, and it's almost musical to him.
Right.
And I'm wondering if, you know, one of the things I love about your poetry, I have a lot of beautiful lines I want to kind of share with the audience, but I just love the language, and I'm wondering if relating to language on the level of sound and rhythm helped contribute to you being a poet at such a young age. Oh my gosh.
I think so. I think there's something about the notes that you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
those sorts of, they become musical notes.
Yeah.
And then, of course, and I don't know if I'm speaking metaphorically here, I guess I am, but there's the silences between the notes.
Mm-hmm.
That communicates so much. I think that there was
yeah.
a lot of depression in my house
oh.
that we never really talked about.
Right, right.
There was a lot of anger, my father being, you know, someone who was just had that political anger, that fire about the Middle East, about Palestine, and I think it was communicated to me, though never really, he never really talked to me necessarily about it.
Oh, Catalina, one of the most beautiful lines that I found in this book of poems, you asked me to talk about the interior. It goes, my father keeps lions in his chest and they rip apart a gazelle in this picture. And she's contemplating it. But that's just such a beautiful, beautiful line. And it almost sounds like what you're what you're talking about. It's like the lion's not quite yet language, but it's going to be, you know?
That's interesting. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah, it's interesting you found out you were a writer so young. So what was your bachelor's degree in? Because you knew you were going to be a poet even when you were pursuing that. What was it in?
It was in the Spanish language, actually. Spanish,
really?
Well, both Spanish and English. It was a kind of dual degree. And I didn't finish college at the normal age when people finish college at 23. It took me something like 11 years.
Oh, me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
At 23, I was probably, you know, taking one class a year and getting a D in it.
Yeah, that was basically me. I was going very, very slowly.
Yeah.
So,
you know, it got to the point to where people were like, "Are you still here? Are you still here?" You know, like, You studied literature, basically.
But I did.
Read a lot
of
books.
I did study literature, yes.
And were you writing poetry as an undergrad?
And yeah, I was always writing.
Okay, and you must have been good because you got accepted as a James Michener Fellow into the University of Texas in Austin. That's huge. You must have been good.
Well, thank you. I was already, by then, when I did my MFA, I was already a writer. I was already publishing.
Right.
I didn't have a book, but I thought, well, what's next after I did finally finish my BA at the University of Missouri? I said,
what city is that in?
Columbia, Missouri. Columbia. So I decided, well, why not find a place that's going to pay me to write?
The perfect job, the dream job, to be paid to write, yes.
Yes. So it was a great 3 years there in Austin.
Right. Yeah. And then when I graduated with my MFA from the University of Oregon, you could still get, there were some jobs out there. You'd have to have a book, a critically acclaimed book, and I didn't get a job because I didn't have a book, you know, right away, so I had to go the community college route for many years. And then today, it's really difficult to get a job with just an MFA. Is that why you went on to get a PhD after your MFA? Because the MFA is supposed to be a terminal degree, but it necessarily may not be so much today.
Yeah, I had the anxiety that it may not be enough. And it was easy. I knew how to apply to school by that point. I wish I could continue. Yeah. And
I bet your statement of purpose was powerful. Have you ever published it? I bet it's good.
I wonder. No, but I do have a file of like seven different versions of the same statement of purpose. I too like artist statements and such things.
Well, you know, we have two programs here, the residential program where you're teaching the graduate poetry workshop and the online MFA. And our decisions, because we get a lot of applicants, are based on not only the writing sample, but the statement of purpose, because that is a writing sample. It's your narrative as a writer.
Right.
You know, why are you here? Why do you want to be a writer?
I got my MFA, and then right after, actually, I applied to fellowships. And I got a fellowship at Bucknell University. They have a poetry center there. And that poetry center offers a fellowship to do various things. You get time to write, but also arts administrative work with the center itself. And you get to work at West Branch, the literary journal there.
Oh, so, nice. So, and in 2016... your book came out. You asked me to talk about the interior, and by then you were already in the PhD program at the University of Denver. Was that a stressful time to have a PhD to finish and also a book coming out and having to promote it?
Well, so it took about 2 years from its acceptance and then the publication. It arrived, seriously, the day right before my comprehensive exams started.
Oh my God. What a war going inside of you, huh?
Yes. So I was overjoyed to see it.
Right.
I remember when the delivery person walked up the steps and dropped it off. And it made taking the exam easier, happier,
wow,
actually.
That's good.
But at the same time, I was just too tired afterwards to actually do the right kind of promotion, the work that people do and line up.
Right.
It's a lot of work.
It is. And you got to be good at it.
You have to want to do it.
I don't
know how much I really wanted to fly. I don't know. I don't like travel very much. I like hotel rooms. I like once I'm there. But I don't like the whole travel.
Yeah, hotel rooms. I like hotel rooms, too. I like you could just, you know,
lay
on the bed, turn on the TV.
Mm-hmm. The solitude.
Yeah.
The solitude, and you don't have to make the bed. And
right. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I had a book come out this year, and I'm just not motivated to start, you know, putting those books in the trunk of my car and traveling and doing readings and,
mm-hmm,
and stuff like that. I understand how you feel. So you got your PhD, and then you're the visiting professor, the very first DeWitter fellow professor here at, so congratulations. I'm really glad you're here.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit specifically about the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's called You Asked Me to Talk About the Interior, and it's by Naomi Press,
mm-hmm,
which is a fantastic press.
Noemi Press.
Noemi.
Yeah.
Did I say it wrong again?
A lot
I always
of people
say
it, yeah.
You know what else I also say wrong? Fugue.
Fugue.
I always say that wrong. I don't even remember what it is. It's fugue, right?
It is. Well, that's how we, you know, I'm sure there are other people who say it differently.
But which is a great press. Let's talk about the title. You asked me to talk about the interior. Who is the you? And why this title?
I don't quite know. You know, in my, this is something I haven't verified, but I think that maybe it might be like a refracted phrase from a book that I had been reading.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it's not mentioned, because I think that I fell in love with the line and then forgot its source. But I have this anxiety that it actually comes from Kate, the poet. Her name is Kate Greenstreet, who's just a terrific poet of smallness, I guess, of very intimate moments.
Mm.
And perhaps it comes, it's certainly, I feel like I was very influenced by her.
Right, right.
Who is the you? I don't know. Who do you think the you is?
I don't know. Maybe the you is self, or maybe the you is, you know, somebody who's interested in the story that emerges from
right.
this. There's a lot of different narratives that
I
emerge
do,
from this.
And I do think it is the reader who wants to listen there.
Right.
I'm teaching the course on what I'm calling whispering poetics.
Uh-huh.
And I think that the intimacy between the reader, the book, and the writer, that triangulated mm-hmm. intimacy is important to me.
Yeah.
The way that I understand poetry.
That's a good word for this book, this collection, now that you mention it, because I mean, I'm, you know, I read a lot of poetry collections because of this interview. You know, I'm not a poet. I'm a fiction writer. I don't teach poetry, but I read a lot of poetry because of this.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I almost felt like I got to know somebody's interiors.
Mm-hmm.
I got to know some the things that you don't project. I felt like you were telling me intimate things, secrets. And I'm thinking specifically of this really beautiful long poem, which is called Veronica's of a Matador.
Mm-hmm.
That's really painful in many ways. Can you tell us a little bit about that poem? And
yeah.
is that the, I sense that that poem somehow is the center of the experience, perhaps?
Mm-hmm. I think that my son has a lot, my relationship, my mothering mm-hmm. of my son has a lot to do with that poem.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a poem, well, first of all, let me just say what the Veronicas are. I had learned what Veronicas were. I mean, that's the movement that the matador makes with the cape in the ring. And as you know, the cape is red and black, and the flashing of the cape attracts the bull to come closer.
Oh, okay.
attracts the bull to charge. And often the matador has the, I don't know if it's called the epaulette, I forget what the sword is called, but the thing that will lance.
Yeah. Okay, I got the picture,
the
yeah.
The bull is often hiding behind the cape. So, and I thought the poems move that way. They're short little sections.
And they end with jabs?
And they end with something painful, something that wounds.
Oh, that's beautiful. You know, I don't think that occurred to me the first time that I read it.
Right.
Now I kind of want to go back and read it again because, yeah, they are very short, you know, incredibly painful pieces.
But my son at the time was learning to come out of his shell.
Mm-hmm.
He had been diagnosed with autism a couple years prior. Mm-hmm. And this was well before the book was published.
Right.
But I think really it was poetry that helped him really learn how to speak. We would walk around Austin and we would play what we called a rhyming game.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say a word and then he would repeat something, some sort of rhymed word.
Right. I love that game.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
And that figures in to that poem.
Yeah, there's some beautiful moments when he's rhyming words in the poem and playing that game. Yeah, I'm not a poet, but I love to read poetry because I get lines like the one I read to you earlier about the father carrying the lion in his chest. And then there's another one about a father, and it says, I just want to go over this. All my father's sadness began to stomp and huff as a line of brittled Central Park horses. That's beautiful. How did that line come about? Do you remember, or did it just come out?
I can say that I think in images.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm constantly writing them down.
Right.
And images for me easily lead to similes that.
Yeah. Yeah, you just, you know, essentially follow the language, I guess you can say.
Mm-hmm.
What about, let me share another one. I hope I'm not being too sappy here by just sharing nice lines. But
no.
But here's a beautiful one. It says, this flower here tilts its head like a monk falling asleep. And that's not enough. The next line just kills me in his chair.
Mm.
You know, it's really a beautiful, very peaceful image.
Thank you.
And where are when you write a poem, can you give us a typical writing day? Because you know, a lot more than a lot of people, you have had opportunities to write.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've been very, you know, I guess blessed, hashtag mm-hmm. blessed, you know, with, you know, so what is a typical writing day for you? Or no, better yet, let's say a typical writing week, because I think we tend to, as writers, think of the week more than just like every day is the same, because we have...
Well, there's a lot of pre-writing, or I should say it's part of the method, what I'm about to explain, is that I write in my notebook a lot,
mm-hmm.
and my notebook is often my phone. There's that notes app.
Absolutely. Do you talk into it?
I talk into it, or I text into it.
Mm-hmm.
The notes app is, there's this long, long note where there's just a lot of poetic speech. And so I'll go to the Denver Public Garden and I'll walk around and listen to music and I'll be thinking of a particular poem.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a time at my desk where I assemble the notes into a poem.
Do you have the first line ready to burst out, or do you just start anywhere?
I start anywhere. It's, you know, the first line is often the hardest to find the entry.
Oh, wow.
I'm all about the endings. I love endings.
Uh-huh.
I feel confident where a poem should end.
Uh-huh.
Something about the beginning that I haven't gotten there.
Yeah. And it says in your biography that you are currently working on something called
Hide.
Hide.
Mm-hmm.
What is Hide?
Well, many things. First, it was my PhD dissertation. Mm-hmm. So it's a book of poems. It's about 75% done. And in it are many poems around the work of the Cuban-born American poet. Her name was Ana Mendieta. Uh-huh. Ana Mendieta was a multimedia artist. A lot of her work took place in the 70s, so there was a lot of earth art. And what can I say about her? She died young, at 36.
Oh, that is young.
Yeah. Oh. Seems like her husband, artist Carl Andre, he was accused of murdering her, but then later acquitted. Mm-hmm. So we don't exactly know what happened, but Ana Mendieta did plummet some 30 feet to her death of a window. And it's awful. She was naked. Her death, I don't want to focus too much on her death, but you can't go without mentioning that her work, her death really resembled a lot of the work that she did with her own body. She would make these series of siluetas where she would imprint her own body on mud or sand or dirt and carve out the body shape, this kind of hollow, and fill it with feathers, rose petals, or animal blood. And then she would take photographs and document the slow erosion of that very funerary image. But so, yes, Hyde has a lot of Mendieta in it. I'm still in love with the title. It's been a working title, but I think it's going to be the final title of the book because of that double meaning of Hyde. It is the skin as well as something.
And, you know, it's interesting because when you think about the first title, you asked me to talk about the interior, talking about it because it's hidden, you know, and it's probably going pretty deeply into some dark spaces, I imagine. I imagine there's a lot of duende in this.
There's duende. I hope there's duende.
I bet there is. Oh, my gosh, because, you know, I love your poetry. I think it's beautiful. But, yeah, you do have this wonderful ability to go into really dark, hidden places. So I imagine it's going to be amazing. Carolina Ebeyi, thank you for joining me on Words on a Wire. Before we leave, can you just read a short poem from...
Sure.
You asked me to talk about the interior.
Do you have one in mind?
You know, I have plenty in mind, but I like the... A Hair, the Other in the Veil of Asters.
Okay, what page is that?
I like...
Do you want me to read Punctum?
Okay.
Sawing a Woman in Half?
Yeah.
It's a prose poem. Sawing a Woman in Half. I ride a glorious bus. It is a metaphorical bus, or perhaps, after all, it's a machine for making metaphors. Yes, a gospel tally-ho. It stays put. It doesn't take to the highway, but it carries me places. I rev it up, and it purrs out a line about Juliet. She's a bright golden ball of nuclear fire, a way of apprehending the world. My son, my only son, now 7, teaches me a new measure. Drop everything, sit on the floor and play. See it turn and turn, the red Veronicas, something sharp and wounding behind his cape. When I see a blouse on the clothesline, or a man's shirt next to a blouse drying outside on a stretch of cord in between the buildings, and there is wind enough so that they swing up together, and the cuff of the man's shirt grazes the cuff of the blouse, that's when I believe in the soul. My beautiful friend Khalil warns me it's a problem to appropriate a spirit animal. Though you have to identify, he says, where your spirit belongs, water, air, or land. I think instead I have a spirit fruit. My spirit pricks like a pineapple, how it keeps growing fat in the dark, gold and rank. A song playing in the next apartment can dismantle me. I care less and less about being beautiful. I care every day about being less and less beautiful. When I look at an MRI of my brain, I do not believe in the soul. I love mornings because of the coffee and the possibilities. I continue to believe that poetry contains revolutionary power. Small talk is an art and best performed in the small hours with another naked in bed. I believe the most beautiful thought is that of a holy transfiguration.
That was Carolina Ebeid reading a poem from her collection, You Ask Me to Talk About the Interior. Carolina, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you, Daniel.